This is Geppetta. He smiled at me and kept knitting. At first, second, or even third glance, it was difficult to pin down what made him so much avoided. Rowan's physical effect, godlike jawline, long-lashed eyes, umber skin, rakish quiff of hair, is that of a lightning strike. In full sunlight, the true color of his hair is revealed to be navy blue, and when he scratches his head, as he sometimes does when he's thinking, his hair parts so that the two tiny corkscrews of bone at the front of his skull are visible. Yes, horns. Not scary ones. I think these were intended as a playful touch. The problem with Wayland is that he's a puppet built to human scale. Masterless and entirely alive. No matter how soft his skin appears to be, he is entirely wooden. And it is not known exactly what animates him. No clock ticks in his chest. Rowan is male to me, since he moves and speaks with a grace that reminds me of the boys and men of my Venetian youth. He's female to Myrna. For Rada and Gustav, Rowan is both male and female. Perhaps we read him along the lines of our attractions. Perhaps it really is as arbitrary as that. He just shrugs and says, "Take your pick. I'm mostly Treedo." His fellow students already had all those confusing hormone surges to deal with, so most of them stayed away, though I'm sure they all dreamed of him, her, here, Zir, a body with a tantalizing abundance of contours, this Rowan who is everything but mostly tree. I'm sure Rowan Wayland was dreamed of non-stop. And he's as evasive as any Punchinello I've met. You ask him a question and he somehow makes you answer it for him. Rowan and Rada never really moved past what she called their eye candy and eye candy appreciator relationship. I was the one the eye candy befriended. That surprised me. I remember Rada introducing me to the ghost in her bedroom in anticipation of our knowing each other, at least wanting to know each other because we spoke the same language. But that ghost is a little too aloof for her own good. Rowan Wayland, on the other hand, calls me Geppetta, Empress of the Moon. Since neither of us need sleep, we take night buses, sharing earphones and listening to knitting podcasts. If anyone else on the bus notices anything about us, they assume it's because they're drunk. I've been trying to find a way to make him reveal how he came to be. In my own mind, I've already compared my condition with his, and I've decided that his condition is preferable. He breathes. I do not. It's not that I believe that I could ever have my body back again. The one I used to have, I mean. Those who drove me into this form did what they did, and that's all. I was on my way out, and they thought they were helping me. Instead, they turned motion and intelligible speech into a currency with which personhood is earned. This craving for consideration is the only real difference between my youthful self and the old, old Geppetta of today. The puppets who made me were shocked when I sold them. Shocked because puppets don't need money, but also because of the care I took to separate them. They couldn't understand that at all. No two to the same home, or even to neighboring cities. I consulted maps and made sure each of those puppets would be held apart by forests and deserts and the spans of rivers. The likelihood of any kind of reunion is almost impossible for them. Us. I wonder if that broke their bond. But being able to find an answer to that question would mean my project failed. A shattering so absolute that no word can be picked up again. That's my success. At the end of the second week of Tyche and Myrna's absence, a personal essay was due. The title was something along the lines of, "What Can a Puppet Do?" The students were required to state their current ambitions, and though the statement would receive a grade, it would remain private. In an environment that relied so heavily on public demonstration of progress, This was a rare opportunity to be earnest without simultaneously putting yourself at a severe disadvantage. For this reason, the teachers imposed a word limit so things didn't get out of hand. Rowan claimed that the title made his mind go blank, so I dictated his essay to him, word for word. What can a puppet do? We didn't have an uncynical answer between us, so I simply reassembled a few lines I remembered from lectures I'd heard Brambani give back when he was still in the process of writing War Between the Fingers and the Thumb. The role of the puppeteer is to preserve childlike wonder throughout our lifespans, etc. Rada's essay was so brief that it only met half the required number of words. She copy-pasted the paragraph she'd already written and added a line at the beginning explaining that she was making use of the technique of repetition for the sake of emphasis. Hard copies were required, so Taiki emailed her essay to Rada, who handed it in without reading it and ran off hand in hand with the Grimaldi boy. Rowan Wayland intercepted Taiki's essay before it reached Miss Alfasi's desk, putting a finger to his lips when I began to ask him what he was doing. He read it twice, and then I read it, to see what he was looking for. Last night was moonless, and we took a boat out onto Scapa Flow. There was broken light all across the sky, and columns of cloud twisting and turning through the pieces. Dust and dragon fire. Professor Semyonova said, "That's the Milky Way. As much of it as we can see, anyway." It was so beautiful I kept my eyes on it in case it suddenly disappeared or turned out to be some gigantic illusion. Maybe it was the rocking of the deck, or maybe I stared for too long. But after a while, I felt it all moving against me. The light and the clouds and the darkness, countless stars and planets flying like arrows from a bow hidden farther back. Not that we three on the boat were the target. That was an accident of scale. We crush ants all the time just walking through a park. I thought the best plan was to leave before the sky arrived, just jump into the sea and drown directly. The second best plan was to close my eyes, but Myrna made me keep looking up. She said her own fear had been that those pinpricks of light were growing, and that as they did, she shrank. She made me keep looking up until the panic was singed away. All I knew how to do with puppets, all I used to want to do, was play unsettling tricks. That's not enough anymore. I want to put on stubborn little shows, find places here and there where we get to see what we'd be like if we were actually in control of anything. Cruel fantasies, maybe, but they can't hurt any more than glimpsing a galaxy does. Taiki Shaw. "Good grief, the puppeteers of today," I said, at the same time as Rowan asked me how much I thought Taiki disliked Myrna on a scale of 1 to 10. 8, I said. "Maybe 8.5. Though judging from the essay, she's come round." "Judging from the essay, Geppetta, the dislike currently exceeds 10. Myrna knows how to make people do what she wants, but she doesn't know how to alter their actual thoughts. Yet here's Taiki, suddenly claiming Myrna's aims as her own. Can't you just smell burning in the distance? In a way, it would be entertaining just to sit back and watch Myrna get out-manipulated for once. But I can't do that." "Why not? I would." Rowan told me about a girl who responded to all external stimuli except human touch. That she did not feel at all, which was the reason why from an early age other people scared her and kept getting scarier and scarier until they became almost impossible to cope with. She could see and hear her fellow human beings, but making physical contact was identical to grabbing at thin air. It was like living with hallucinations that would neither disappear nor become tangible. The worst part was having to pretend that this pack of ghouls was nothing to be concerned about. She quickly learned that getting upset was counterproductive, because then there were attempts to comfort her with hugs and the like. She said whatever she had to say and did whatever she had to do to circumvent unnecessary physical contact. But her situation was further complicated by the effect that her touch had on others. She was walking pain relief. She didn't cure or absorb the source of pain. It was more that she dismantled the sensation itself for a few hours, or up to half a day, depending on the duration of skin contact. It didn't matter what kind of affliction the other person suffered. If the girl held his or her hand, pain departed, and all other impressions expanded to fill the space it left. This, more than her numbness, twisted her relationships beyond imagining. People in her immediate vicinity somehow sensed what she could do for them and reached for her without really thinking about it, then clung to her. Friends, family, and strangers making use of her without perceiving that they were doing so, clinging so tightly that her ribs all but cracked. It seemed everybody was in all kinds of pain all the time. Shaggy-haired young men camped on her doorstep with their guitar cases, and the girl's father resorted to spending a part of each evening standing backlit in the sitting room window with his arms folded, so that the doorstep campers got a good view of his lumberjack biceps. The incongruous combination of white hair, beard, and powerful arms usually caused the boys to scatter with the muddled impression that Father Christmas was angry with them. As a form of escape from involuntary giving, the girl tried to identify those who were in the most pain and spent evenings at her local hospital, just sitting with people, holding hands for as long as she could. She tried to do the same on the psychiatric ward, but the security was tighter there. When she came home, she stayed near her mother, whose addiction to painkillers had already caused her to injure herself for the sake of high-strength prescriptions. The woman's nerves tormented her so that only medication prevented her howling, becoming a source of public or even domestic disturbance. From the little that the woman had been able to explain to her, the girl knew that her mother thought strange thoughts she could never tell anyone. Graphic structures appeared on the insides of her eyelids, a minute exhibition of X-ray photographs. There was affection between mother and daughter, but they'd given up trying to express it. Rather than force a display, they simply asked for each other's good faith, and no matter how many times the girl offered her hand, her mother refused it. It was the usual struggle between one who loves by accepting burdens and one who loves by refusing to be one. Really, the mother's pursuit of pills wasn't motivated by the necessity of avoiding pain, but a determination to avoid any feeling at all. That's why the pills were better than holding a child's hand. The girl's father was a puppeteer, and there came a day when he was called to perform in Prague, an honor it would have been difficult to disregard. He'd never dreamed of being noticed by the puppeteers at work in that city, let alone considered a colleague. The professor's wife read this as a sign that she must either break or bend. She told her husband it would be good for him to take their daughter traveling, and checked into a clinic as an answer to her family's anxieties about her being alone. So the girl found herself living in Prague. Rowan himself has no particular view of Prague, but I know it a little, and it was fitting that the likes of Myrna Semyonova was let loose in a city whose streets combined sepia-filtered rainbows and shapes of nightmarish precision. If I truly remember the street Rowan mentioned, then Myrna and her father lived in a building that looked like an avenue of concrete gallows welded together with steel. Apart from enforcing her school attendance, her father left her to her own devices. She was free to watch his rehearsals and performances, or to improve her graffiti skills, aggravate swans on the banks of the Vltava, or anything else that seemed like a good idea. Myrna loved to watch her father with his puppets. He showed her the influence it was possible to have, from a slight distance, so she spent a lot of time at the theater that became his second home. But she also began a correspondence with her mother that pleased them and led to the discovery that both strudel and currant buns remain on the edible side after delivery by 48-hour courier service. From time to time, they briefly discussed recovery, and Myrna began to hear a change in the language her mother used to describe her pain. They were words that spoke more of bending than breaking. Myrna had assumed command over two boys who lived in the flat above her own, Yindrich and Kirill, the Topol brothers. Myrna was both boys' grand passion. They called her London and longed for a chance to rescue her from some danger or other. Sometimes one brother would menace her so that the other could defend her, even though she'd emphasized from the beginning that all she required of them was that they both die for her, if and when such endeavor became necessary. The Topols were in the process of teaching Myrna some Czech, so her instructions were mostly mimed, but the brothers understood her at once. Death frequently crossed their minds, and why shouldn't it, when Myrna had become a participant in their Sunday afternoon wrestling matches in Olshiny Cemetery? Kirill was ferocious, and Yindrich was fleet of foot, but Myrna was nimbler still, and her brutality was fed by her desire not to cheat. Instead of laying hands on her opponent, she wove figures of eight until he was exhausted and some obliging tree branch gave her the height to safely grab Yindrich or Kirill with both feet and slam him to the ground, with the additional offense of forcing him to break her own fall. With its tens of thousands of graves, Prague's Olshiny Cemetery is a large village, a small town in itself. I, Tepeta, have been there, and I know that something travels in that place. Something passes among the trees. I cannot say what this traveler is, since we've never crossed paths, but what I've been able to see for myself is that in some of Olshiny's clearings, leaves lock together and form shadowy bridges from branch to branch, and the barks of these bridged trees peel back to show a color that glistens with rawness and decay, sap and old bone. The Topols and Myrna followed this trail, switching wrestling arenas for about a month, scrambling through swaths of undergrowth, administering the occasional surprise fly kick. No matter how many times it's happened before, it's always startling to be assaulted by a bush. Before they discovered the little wooden devil. The wooden devil had been aware of them for weeks. She was carved of rowan wood, and she retained the opinions of trees, one of them being that it was best not to have anything to do with human folk. "Firstly, they cut us down," Rowan said. "Secondly, they're all insane, though I suppose they can't help that, being rooted in water instead of earth." The wooden devil got a good laugh out of the ones who passed by, though. They were so funny she couldn't even feel sorry for them. They tried so hard to keep track of time. Whenever they were together, they couldn't let 60 of their minutes pass without asking each other what time it was, as if time was a volatile currency that they either possessed or did not possess, when in fact time was more of a fog that rose inexorably over all their words and deeds so that they were either forgotten or misremembered. The wooden devil's official duty was to guard the grave of an alchemist named Rowan Wayland. The grave was empty. In fact, it was one of seven scattered across the continent, and the other six were empty too. As an alchemist, Wayland had liked the idea of implying that he'd excelled at his profession. This could only work if he left absolutely no evidence of having died. His plan had worked. 6 centuries had passed, and the residents of the streets surrounding the cemetery still didn't feel they could rule out the possibility of his being around somewhere. Every 14th of July, without fail, the town council received a bag of antique gold from an anonymous benefactor, symbolic payment for Wayland's burial plot. It was actually somewhat unlikely that this payment came from Wayland himself, since the main reason King Rudolf had ordered the alchemist's execution was his failure to produce gold from base metal as promised. Wayland had good friends. They arranged for a wooden puppet to be buried in place of his body. The man himself had fled the Czech lands and lived to advance his career in other royal courts. The wooden devil had been through a lot since she'd been discovered to be the grave's sole inhabitant. She'd been waxed and lacquered and pegged to the earth, frozen, drenched, and dried out again. She'd even seen the traveller in the trees, spinning as a wheel does. The life in the wooden devil was slight and vague, only a little more than that possessed by inanimate puppets, but it was maintained by the fact that the first impression she gave was one of humanity. Graveyard visitors approaching the wooden devil from behind tended to mistake her for someone about the same age as Myrna Semyonova was at that time, and would confidently strike up conversation, though they were either sheepish or oddly repulsed when they discovered their mistake. At any rate, this persistence of address cultivated a silent response. The wooden devil had a good vantage point and served as secret audience to a few Topol Semyonova wrestling matches. The devil was slightly worried that Myrna and the boys would make a nuisance of themselves once they found her. But there was one tree that the wooden devil thought of as her mother, because this tree had murmured soothingly to her when she'd still been coming up as a sapling. That tree watched over her still, and murmured what the elder trees at Olshiny always murmured. Topo minulo, stenye, muje, itole. That went by, so can this. The tree was right. This situation wasn't unique. The children were most likely to run for their lives as soon as they saw her. Myrna saw the devil before the Topol brothers did, and she approached without calling out. She read the name on the headstone and brushed a little lichen out of the devil's hair. Her gentleness left the devil nonplussed. It was highly irregular for anyone to be curious enough about the feel of her to voluntarily touch her, and nobody had ever seemed quite so pleased by their findings. The boys overdid their nonchalance, treating the devil's shoulders as coat pegs. The girl's front door keys were always falling out of her pockets, so she left them on the devil's lap before chucking her under the chin and saying, "Thanks, Rowan." A sequence of elaborate stretches followed, and then Yendrich and Kirill were ready to fight, with Myrna playing referee. It was a highly unusual afternoon for the wooden devil, who was intensely aware of the arm that Myrna had casually flung around her shoulders, as if they were friends who had come to that place together. Around dinner time, the boys took their jackets back, but Myrna left her door keys and didn't miss them until she reached her front door and stuck her hand into the pocket of her jeans. Her father was still at the theater, so the Topols took her in for the evening. After dinner, Kirill adjusted the lamplight until he'd created the correct conditions for shadow play, and Myrna put on a little show. Her makeshift shadow puppets quarreled among themselves, hands thrown up, "What to do? What to do?" A spoon-headed creature had suddenly appeared in their midst and befriended their youngest boy. "I promised him he could live with us." The shadow mother forbade this.
"Absolutely not! Send this fellow on his way, son."
The boy set up a tent in the garden and courteously asked the spoon-headed creature to enter and consider himself at home. The spoon-headed creature offered to go away, as he didn't want to bother anybody, but the boy insisted. The shadow father was just puncturing the tent with a fork when the Topol's doorbell shrilled. This was followed by urgent knocking and then the sound of very heavy clogs clattering away as fast as they could. Myrna and Mr. Topol ran out onto the street, but all they found were ordinary soft-shoed citizens. The lights were on in Myrna's flat. She knocked and waved goodnight to Mr. Topol, but when her front door clicked open, seemingly by itself, she knew that her father wasn't at home. Her father was not a man to hide himself behind a door as he pulled it open. She called out,
"Dad?"
Anyway, but there was no answer. She only really started shaking when she saw her key ring on the hall table. She considered running to fetch Yindrich or Kirill or both, but she didn't like to turn her back on that open door, and besides, Mrs. Topol had been complaining of an especially bad headache all evening, and she didn't know how many more times she could politely shrug off the woman's surreptitious attempts to touch her before the situation became awkward. So she called Yindrich Topol on the telephone, even though he was only a flight of stairs away. She talked about nothing and kept talking about nothing as she walked through the flat, room by room. Everything was just as usual in every room, except her bedroom, where, being well-versed in the horror story search procedures, Myrna looked under her bed last and found Rowan Wayland lying flat on her back, filled with loathing for keys. A key ring gets left in your care, and you reject all responsibility for it, yet can't bring yourself to throw it away. Nor can you just give the thing away. To whom can someone of good conscience give such an object as a key? Always up to something, stitching paths and gateways together, even as it sits quite still, its powers of interference can only be guessed at. The wooden devil suspected keys cause more problems than they solve. So she followed Myrna with one plan in mind, to do her bit to restore order. Myrna's home had seemed like a clever and strictly temporary hiding place, but with typical slyness the keys had let Rowan in and then been of no assistance whatsoever when it came to getting out. All that skinship shared by friends, families, and lovers, Myrna had seen plenty of it and had proudly despised them for needing such comforts. Now that she had tried and liked a little of it, shyly, Myrna reached for Rowan again, touched her wooden wrist, and felt something like a pulse flicker through it. She feared it would be hard to go on without any more. It took time for Rowan and Myrna to understand each other's words. They had to take hold of each other and think clearly, then know. Finders, keepers.
Zabavino nalischem.
And humans only lived a few years. So afterward Rowan could go home again, back to half-sleep and voices that asked nothing of her. She and Myrna took their time presenting the situation to Professor and Mrs. Semyonov. They waited until the family was reunited in London, their chief concerns being that Mrs. Semyonova might call in an exorcist, and the professor might try to find out how to make more living puppets by taking Rowan apart. But the Semyonovs weren't like that. There were a few words of Neruda's they were fond of. "I don't know anything about light, from where it comes nor where it goes. I only want the light to light up." Rowan took a little bow, to indicate that he'd told all that he wished to tell. "What are you going to do?" I asked. He sighed. "I'm afraid Myrna is not turning out well. All she seems to have learned is a way to take pain away without touching anybody." "And that's bad?" "It is if your method involves causing the pain in the first place. But don't worry, I'll deal with her and Tyke both. But the main thing for you is that though you wish to alter your condition, that wish will not be granted through me, if at all." I made no reply, since he'd given me much to consider. How much of this do I tell Radha? As much as will change her feelings. None of it, then. Rowan carried me home in his rucksack. To Radha's house, not Myrna's. Gustav answered the door. Behind him, Radha was practicing a choreographed dance with Petrushka and Loco Dempsey, jumping in and out of different pairs of shoes. "I'm sorry," Rowan said as he set me down on the doorstep. "For what?" Gustav asked, laughing, but Rowan just plugged his earphones in and sauntered off. Tyke and Myrna came back from Scotland with tender new constellations, one tattooed on Tyke's left arm and the other on Myrna's right. They'd chosen a configuration of four brilliant stars collectively called the Chameleon. Rowan looked on impassively as Myrna tucked notes into Tyke's locker for her to read later. Tyke whispered her replies into Myrna's ear, and Myrna smiled in a way that most onlookers took as confirmation of erotic intimacy, though, knowing what I did about Myrna's aversion to flesh, I doubted it. As for Rodda, the fight never quite went out of her. She admired the tattoos, continued to fluster Myrna by cheerfully calling her wife to her face, and invited Tyke and Myrna puppet shopping, though she returned from those trips empty-handed. Music was the only thing that exposed her. She found that she was too easily brought to tears by it, and skipped so many tracks on her playlist that I lost my temper and switched the music off altogether, leaving her to work at her desk amid a silence she looked grateful for. At times she held her head in her hands and laughed softly and ruefully. She found notification of a missed call from Gustav on her phone one night, and made no attempt to return the call, but stayed up late, very, very late, in case he tried again. He didn't. Ah, really, it was too annoying how bold these ones were when they were in each other's company, and how timid they were when apart. It was beneath me to knock all their pretty heads together and shout, "Exactly what are you trying to do with each other?" But it was my hope that Rowan would. Rowan was more interested in knitting a snowflake shawl, so Rada continued writing for Gustav's puppets unhindered. She was scripting her contribution to the school's end-of-term show. The working title was Polixena the Snitch, and all that I was permitted to know about it was that it was mostly set in a karaoke bar for gangsters. The segment following Polixena the Snitch belonged to Tyke and Myrna, who were working on an idea of Tyke's they called The Shock of Your Life or A Piece of Cheese. We, the audience, received cards in advance. One version of the card read, "Shock," and beneath that word was an instruction to write a name, "Cannot be your own." The other version of the card read, "Piece of cheese," and again there was space to write a name that was not your own. These cards provoked shudders of euphoric terror that only increased as the day and then the hour itself drew even closer. The card spoke to a suspicion that many whose work is play can never be free of. That you can only flaunt your triviality for so long before punishment is due. A date has been selected, and on that day there will be a great culling. We filed into the school theater chattering with nerves. The volume increased when we were handed pens at the entrance, and informed that choices made in pencil would not be accepted. When we sat down, nobody removed their coats or bags. Everybody was ready to evacuate immediately. Poor Rada and Gustav. Their performance was merely something to sit through as we got ready for our shocks or our pieces of cheese. Gustav's puppet troupe was already on stage, seated on chairs with their backs to us. Brunhild, the shipbuilder, was tallest of them, and I could see the top of her head. There was a strangeness in the way that head was positioned. I accept that this is an almost meaningless thing to say about the posture of a puppet, which is intrinsically all sorts of strange. But still, I began to mention this to Rada, but Tyke and Rowan sat down beside us, and I thought better of it. Tyke asked Rada which card she'd got, "Shock or piece of cheese?" Rada smiled very sweetly and said, "Wait and see." And Gustav walked on stage to the sound of TLC's "No Scrubs." As he did, the puppet's chairs turned, and after that everything compressed into a split second. We saw that every single one of the puppet's throats had been slashed wide open so that they erupted strings. They'd been hacked at so savagely that even those internal strings were cut. And when Gustav saw them, he lost consciousness. He didn't collapse exactly. It was more as if he'd been dropped from a height. He fell plank straight and without making a sound, and that fall of his was just as unreal to us as the glazed eyes with which the puppets on stage surveyed their own innards. Their expressions were the kind that couldn't be altered unless physically dismantled. Each smile, scowl, or beseeching look disappearing piece by piece. Laughter was the first response, perhaps the only natural response to such excess. It felt intended that we laugh. Puppets and puppeteer slain by an unknown hand. For about 30 seconds the scene was so complete that no one dared intrude upon it. Then Gustav's friends began to call out to him, reminding him that they'd always known he was too serious for comedy, demanding the next scene, telling him that it was time to get up, that they needed to know if he was okay. From where we sat, he seemed to be comfortably asleep, and No Scrubs played on until Rada ran onto the stage, lifted the boy into her arms, turned his head to the side, and we saw that his eyes were open. Then it became official that Gustav wasn't sleeping. Those of us in the front row even saw his eyes. They were like a void made visible. Professor Semyonova himself climbed onto the stage, checked vital signs, and shouted for someone to call an ambulance. The professor called for his daughter, too, and she arrived on the stage among a swarm of other students proffering bottles of water and tiger balm and scarves and asking, "Is he breathing? Is he breathing?" Taiki, Rowan, and I were the only ones who stayed where we were. That probably made us look guilty of something, but moving closer to the stage would have broken our concentration. Myrna said something to Rada that caused her to release Gustav and turn her attention to the maimed puppets, gathering the bodies one by one, running her fingers through Hamlet's hair, knocking on Petrushka's helmet, closing eyes, pair by pair. As she did so, Myrna clasped Gustav to her. "Did you know she liked him that much?" I heard one boy ask another. All of her body against all of his body. He moved his head, seemed to return to himself, and pushed her away, his hand seeking only Rada's. Myrna stepped back into the crowd with a look of shock. What caused it? That the dose she'd given was enough for him? Or the way Rada bent over him, looking into those sad eyes that had grown even sadder from the day he'd chosen her? My guess, the biggest surprise, was that by looking at each other in this way, they were hurting Myrna. A little pain, just enough to quicken her breathing. Taiki was half out of her seat trying to decide whether to go to Myrna or not, and Rowan tried to give me a high five, which I ignored. "As expected," he said, and looked about him with an air of fulfillment that made it plain he was referring to more than just my snub.
Drownings. This happened, and it didn't happen. A man threw a key into a fire. Yes, there are people who do such things. This one was trying to cure a fever. He probably wouldn't have done it if he'd had his head on straight. But it's not easy to think clearly when rent is due, and there isn't enough money to pay it. And one who relies on you falls ill for want of nourishment, but you have to leave him to walk around looking for work to do. Then when you find some, there still isn't enough money for both food and shelter, and the worry never stops for a moment. Somehow it would be easier to go home to the one who relies on you if they greeted you with anger or even disappointment. But returning to someone who has made their own feeble but noticeable attempts to make the place a little nicer while you were gone, someone who only says, "Oh, never mind," and speaks of tomorrow as they turn their trusting gaze upon you, it was really too much, as if tomorrow was up to him, or any of us. There's that difficulty with delirium, too. You see it raging in another person's eyes, and then it flickers out. That's the most dangerous moment. It's impossible to see something that so swiftly and suddenly swallowed you whole. Acardes's debts were so numerous that when he found himself being beaten up by strangers, he no longer bothered to ask who they were or why they were hitting him. He just assumed it was something to do with his repayments. Instead of putting up much of a fight, he concentrated on limiting damage to his internal organs. A friend of a friend of his knew a woman who bought people's organs in advance of their death. This woman bought your organs, and then made your death relatively nice for you. An accident when you least expected it. A surprise release from life. Once that was taken care of, she paid the agreed sum in full, cash in the hands of a person of your choice. Acardi felt his heart and lungs throughout the day. They felt hardy enough. So he had a plan Z. Why go straight to Z, though? Throwing the key into the fire was the first step of this man's fever-born plan. The second step involved the kidnapping of a girl he had seen around. He felt no ill will toward this girl, and this was in itself unusual, since his desperation had begun to direct him to linger on the street, wishing misfortune upon everyone he saw. That lady's maid hurrying out of the jeweler's shop, he wished she would lose some item of great value to her mistress, so that he might find it and sell it. Yes, let the lady's maid face every punishment for her carelessness. He wouldn't spare a single thought for her. As he passed the Grand Café on his city's main boulevard, he wished a dapper waiter carrying a breakfast tray would slip and fall so that he could retrieve the trampled bread rolls. And how would it be if this time the waiter had slipped and fallen one time too many and was dismissed? Even better, then I can replace him. The girl he planned to kidnap happened to be a tyrant's daughter. Hardly anybody disliked her. She was tall and vague, exceedingly vague. Her tendency toward the impersonal led to conversations that ended with both parties walking away thinking, well, that didn't go very well. If you mentioned that you weren't having the best day, she might tell you about certain trees that drank from clouds when you couldn't find enough moisture in the ground beneath them. She was known as Irini, the second of Irini the Fair, since she had a flair for the judicious distribution of cake, praise, blame, and other sources of strife. In terms of facial features, she didn't really look like anybody else in her family. In fact, she resembled a man her mother had secretly loved for years, a man her mother had never so much as spoken to, until the day the tyrant decided to have his wife, Irini the First, stoned for adultery. He did give her a chance. One chance. He asked her to explain why his eyesight kept telling him that his daughter was in fact the child of another man, but the woman only answered that there was no explanation. The man Irini the First loved heard about the resemblance between himself and the child and came down to the palace to try to stop the execution. He swore to the tyrant that he and Irini the First were as good as strangers, but the tyrant waved him away and signaled his executioners to prepare themselves, at which point the man Irini the Fair resembled ran into the center of the amphitheater, where Irini the First stood alone with her arms forming a meager shield for her face and chest. The man Irini the Fair resembled stood before her with his back to the executioners and the tyrant and told her to look at him, just to keep looking only at him, and that it would be all right. It seemed he intended to protect her from the stones until he couldn't any more. This was intolerable to the tyrant. He could not allow these two to exit together. There was also a sense of having just witnessed the first words they'd ever said to each other. The tyrant feared a man who had no qualms about involving himself in a matter such as this. So instead of going ahead with the execution, he had his wife returned to the palace. As for the man Irini resembled, he asked to see the child just once. He'd never been more curious about anybody in his life, he said. but his request was denied, and the tyrant had him drowned, as had been the case with all other enemies of the tyrant state. All any citizen had to say was, "The last king was better," and somehow or other Irene's father got to hear of it, and then you were drowned in the grey marshlands, deep in the heart of the country, far from even the most remote farmhouse. The air was noxious where the drowned were. The water took their bones and muscle tissue, but bubbles of skin rose from the depths, none of them frail, some ready for flight, brazen leather balloons. Houses throughout the country stood empty because the tyrant had eliminated their inhabitants. The swamp of bone and weights and plasma also had house keys mixed into it, since many had been drowned fully clothed along with the contents of their pockets. Irene the Fair was aware of the keys. She visited the marshlands as often as she dared, crossing narrow stone bridges with a lantern in her hand. She went there to thank the man she resembled for what he had done, but he couldn't be separated from the rest of the drowned. Irene the Fair swung her lantern around her in a circle, and when her tears met the water they told their own meaning as they flowed from eye socket to eye socket. Among those the tyrant hadn't drowned yet, there was a great eagerness to be rid of him. And Arkady knew that if he went through with his plan to kidnap the tyrant's daughter, he would not be without support. The tyrant had started off as an ordinary king, no better or worse than any other, until it had occurred to him to test the extent of his power. And once he found out how much power he really had, he took steps to maintain it. A ration system was in place, not because resources were scarce or because it was necessary to conserve them, but because the tyrant wished to covertly observe the black market and see what exchanges people were willing and able to make. Not just goods, but time. How much time could his subjects bear to spend queuing for butter? What about medicine? This was the sort of thing that made life for his subjects harder than life was for citizens of neighboring countries. Irene the Fair was sure that her father was detested. He was a man who only laughed when he was about to give some command that was going to cause widespread panic. She didn't doubt that if anybody saw a way to annoy her father by harming her, they might well do it. But she was well guarded, and it escaped her notice that she was being intensely observed by the kind of person who would melt a key. The tyrant had orphaned him, had had Arkady's mother and father drowned in the middle of the night, so that the boy woke in an empty house wondering why nobody was there to give him breakfast. Young Arkady prepared his own breakfast that day, and continued to do so until there was no more food. And then he went out onto the street, and stayed there, leaving the front door open in case anybody else had a use for his family home. Two companions crossed his path. The first was Giacomo, the one who came to depend upon him. Arkady had happened to overhear a grocer trying to make Giacomo pay 3 times the going rate for a bar of soap. "I know the soap looks just like all the rest, but it'll actually get you thrice as clean." Giacomo was cheerfully scraping coins together when Arkady intervened, inquiring whether the grocer was enjoying his existence as a piece of garbage, whether it was a way of life the grocer felt he could recommend. Giacomo was not a person who knew what a lie was or why anybody would tell one. His mind worked at a different speed than usual. Not slower exactly, but it did take him a long time to learn some things, especially practicalities regarding people. Light felt like levitation to Giacomo, and darkness was like damnation. How had he lived so long without being torn apart by one or the other? He was so troublesome taking things that then had to be paid for, paying for things that shouldn't have cost anything. He taught Arkady patience, looking at him with wonder and saying, "Arkady is good." It was Giacomo who was good. His ability to give the benefit of the doubt never faltered. The swindlers didn't mean it, The jeers didn't mean it, and those who would stamp on a child's hand to make her let go of a banknote she had been given, those people didn't mean it either. Their other companion was a Vizsla puppy, now a deep gold-coloured dog who began to follow Arkady and Giacomo one day and would not be shooed away, no matter how fierce an expression Arkady assumed. Since Giacomo's alphabet and numerical coordination were unique to him, it was rare for him to be gainfully employed. So the dog merely represented an additional mouth for Arkady to feed. But the Vizsla's persistence and tail-wagging served him well, as did his way of behaving as if he had once been a gentleman and might yet regain that state. The Vizsla waited for Giacomo and Arkady to help themselves to portions of whatever meals they were able to get before he took his own share, though sometimes Giacomo pressed the dog to begin, in which case he took the smallest portion and not a bite more. Giacomo named him Leporello. On occasions of his own choosing, Leporello turned backflips and earned coins from passers-by. And yet he couldn't be persuaded to perform on demand. No, he would give looks that asked Arkady to perceive the distinction between artist and mere entertainer. The three of them settled in a building at the edge of the city. The view from the building's windows was an unexpectedly nice one, covering miles and miles of marshland so that the mass of drowned flesh looked like water. Just muddy water, if not wholly pure, then becoming so as it teemed toward the ocean. One day, while Arkady was out working one of his three jobs, Giacomo came home from a long walk, stopped on the wrong floor of their building and accidentally opened the door to a flat that wasn't the one he shared with Arkady and Leporello. The tenant wasn't at home, so Giacomo could have seen or taken anything he wished. But what he sought was a view from a new window, and that was all he took. 10 minutes looking out to sea, and he soon discovered that the same key opened every door in the building. The landlord counted on it, not occurring to any of the tenants to try opening doors other than their own. When Giacomo told Arkady of his discovery, Arkady was all for having the locks changed. They could be murdered in their beds. They could be robbed at any time. It was bad enough that they lived under the rule of a tyrant who was slowly but surely squeezing the life out of everybody. But now their neighbors could get at them too. Giacomo just laughed and pulled Arkady into one of the flats that stood empty between tenants on a floor higher than theirs. Leporello came to and barked at the moonlight as it washed over their faces. Their fellow tenants continued to identify their doorways with care and were too busy and too tired to go anywhere but home. Having secured Giacomo's assurance that he'd be very, very careful with these trespassers of his, and Leporello's assurance that he'd help Giacomo keep his word, Arkady's worries were lessened for a time. One of his jobs was assisting the tyrant's physician, who did not choose to be known by her true name, or perhaps was yet to discover it, and went by the nickname Locum. Like the confection, she left traces of herself about anybody she came into contact with. Sweetness, fragrance. Ah, so you've been with her. Locum kept the tyrant in perfect health and perfectly lovesick, too. Like the tyrant's wife, Locum had no lovers. Anybody who seemed likely to win her favor was immediately drowned. Arkady swept and mopped Locum's chambers, and he fetched and carried covered baskets for her, and he also acted as her test subject. This was his favorite job, because all he was required to do was sit on a stool and eat different colored pieces of locum that the physician had treated with various concoctions. He was also required to describe in detail what he felt happening in his body a few minutes after the consumption of each cube. And some of the morsels broke his cells wide open and made it all but impossible to find words and say them. Though for the most part, accurate description was no great task for him, and it paid more than his other two decidedly more mundane jobs. "Open your mouth," she'd say, and then she placed a scented cube on his tongue. He'd warned himself not to behave like everybody else who came within 10 paces of her, but once as the locum melted away, he found himself murmuring to her, "I remember a dawn when my heart got tied in a lock of your hair." Her usual response was flat dismissal. She all but pointed to the door and said, "Please handle your feelings over there." But this time she took one end of the scarf she wore and wrapped it around his neck, drawing him closer and closer until her face was just a blur. "Listen. Listen," she said. "People have been drowned for saying much less." Akadi could make no retort to that. She was only telling the truth. He thought that was the end of the matter, but as he was leaving, she told him not to come back. She said jealousy lent people uncanny powers of detection, and that it was better not to be so close within the tyrant's reach if he wanted to go on living. He protested without the wages she paid him, he, Giacomo, and Le Perello could hardly keep afloat. But she shook her head and motioned to him to be quiet, mouthed, "For your own good," scattered a tray of locum on the floor and shouted, "That's enough clumsiness from you!" Loudly enough for the guards just outside the door to hear, and sent him on his way, flinging the tray after him to complete the dismissal scene. He didn't like that, of course. Locum's taking it upon herself to decide what was for his own good. He could drown if he wanted to. In the weeks that followed, that unfillable gap in his funds drowned him anyway. Unpaid bills and nobody willing to employ him without speaking to Locum, who refused to show him any favor. Giacomo and Le Perello spoke less and stared out of the windows more. Arcadi knew that they weren't getting enough to eat, but Giacomo wasn't the sort to complain, and Le Perello dared not. Giacomo's fever didn't take hold until Arcadi missed 3 rent payments in a row, and the trio were evicted from the building with the views that Giacomo was so fond of. Arcadi was able to find them a room, a small one with a small grate for cooking. It was a basement room, and Giacomo seemed crushed by the floors above them. He wouldn't go out. He asked where the door was and searched the walls with his hands. Le Perello led him to the door of the room, but he said, "That's not it," and stayed in the corner with his hands reverently wrapped around a relic, the key to their previous flat. "The key to where we really live, Arcadi." How Arcadi hated to hear him talk like that. Giacomo and Le Perello had stolen the key between them, Le Perello putting on a full acrobatic display and then standing on his back legs to proffer a genteel paw to the landlord while Giacomo made a getaway with the key. In his head, Giacomo pieced together all those views of the same expanse. Sometimes he tried to describe the whole of what he saw to Arcadi, but his fever made a nonsense of it all. Arcadi took the key from Giacomo to put an end to his ramblings, and he threw the key into the fire to put an end to the longing that raged through his body and vexed his brain. "This is where we really live, Giacomo. Here, in a basement, with a door you say you cannot find." Then Arcadi turned his back on Le Perello's growling and Giacomo's sobs as he tried to snatch the key back from the grate. He fell asleep with the intention of kidnapping Irini the Fair in the morning. The palace watchwords hadn't changed, he had checked. He would be glib and swift and resolute and have the girl at his mercy before she or anyone grasped the situation. He would demand that the tyrant take his damn foot off the nation's neck and let everybody breathe. Money, too. He'd ask for a lot of that. Enough for medicine and wholesome meat broth and a proper bed and all the sea breeze his friends could wish for. He dreamed of the key writhing in the fire, and he dreamed of faces coughing out smoke amidst the flames, each face opening up into another like the petals of a many-layered sunflower, and he was woken by police officers. They shone light into his eyes and pummeled him and ordered him to confess now while they were still being nice. Confess to what? The officers laughed at his confession. confess to what, he was asking, when the building he'd been evicted from had burned to the ground overnight, and he'd been the one who'd set the fire. Almost half the inhabitants had been out working their night jobs, but everybody else had been at home, and there were 9 who hadn't escaped in time. So, there were 9 deaths on his head. Akadi maintained that he'd set no fire, that he